You're listening to Gossip Int, the way to gossip intelligently. Gossip Int is a podcast that helps listeners learn critical thinking concepts by applying them to well-known pop culture events and real-world technology-focused examples. Here with us today, we have Karen Frost and Caitlin Hopkins, and I'm Bobby Jane Apostolos. Details on our backgrounds in threat intelligence and cybersecurity can be found in the podcast bio. Although all three of our participants today do work for Microsoft, the views expressed on this podcast belong to us alone and do not represent the views of Microsoft. Welcome to our creative world of Gossip Int.
So last week, we discussed the Dunning-Kruger effect, and we discussed several great examples, actually, of this bias. We hope that you as listeners were able to see the Dunning-Kruger bias out there in the wild on both ends of the spectrum. But moving on to this week, we're going to be discussing another great cognitive bias, which I think is explained exactly how it sounds. Karen, can you start us off on telling us a little bit about today's cognitive bias?
Today, we're talking about something called groupthink. Have you ever heard someone derogatorily refer to a group of people as lemmings or sheep? What that person is doing is accusing the people in the group of the biased groupthink. They're implying that the group members are acting thoughtlessly, without appropriate critical thinking. Now, we all know that when someone uses those terms, they're probably about to launch into an illusory superiority rant, but you get my point about how groupthink is generally understood by laymen.
Yeah, I really hate when people use that term, like sheeple or sheep. In my experience, the users are generally not much free thinkers themselves.
I do think it's a bit overrated, but let's talk about what groupthink is. Groupthink is a phenomenon in which a group of people, in a conscious or unconscious effort to preserve cohesion or harmony, come to a conclusion that is ultimately irrational or dysfunctional. In an effort to preserve conformity, the group tries to minimize conflict, but this means that things like contrarian ideas or critical evaluation have a tendency to fall to the wayside. For example, let's say someone decided that wearing underwear on the outside of your clothing was cool. All the celebrities started doing it. Objectively, we all know it's a bad idea. But in an effort to seem hip and popular, some people would start copying the trend and talking about how avant-garde it is. Groupthink in action.
Okay, Karen, but that's just creative fashion marketing. You get big celebrities to buy in and bam. I mean, underwear just flying off the shelves.
It does beg the question of what is fashion? Or we might just call it sheeple. Anyway, Irving Janis, who pioneered initial research on groupthink, described groupthink as a deterioration in mental efficiency, reality testing, and moral judgments as a result of group pressures.
Okay, so first question. Is all group thinking groupthink? Like, if my family and I all agree on something, such as like peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, so the peanut butter has to go on both sides of the bread, right? For peanut butter and jelly sandwich, obviously. Does that constitute as groupthink bias?
No. Or at least probably not. I don't know your family. Groupthink is in essence characterized by dysfunction. And also, who puts peanut butter on both sides of the sandwich?
Okay, then yeah, totally. It is groupthink then. If dysfunction is the description or the definition, then yes, totally.
Anyway, in groupthink, individuals are afraid to raise alternative hypotheses or feel it better to accept the consensus decision rather than suggest a different solution. The group dynamic becomes one of an in-group versus an out-group. The in-group overweights its own decision-making while denigrating and rejecting the decision-making of the out-group. Members of the in-group become afraid to go against the prevailing opinions of the group, fearing that by rocking the boat, they'll be cast out. For anyone who's thinking this sounds suspiciously like how some high school cliques work, that's exactly right. I'm thinking here of Lacey Chabert's character Gretchen Wieners in the 2004 movie Mean Girls, but that movie was almost 20 years ago, so that reference might not make sense to some listeners.
Again, with the vicious attacks on our age, my age, but that is a pretty good example.
I absolutely love Mean Girls. It's such an iconic and quotable early 2000s movie. But have you guys ever seen those viral experiment videos where they tell a room full of actors to all do something outrageous or out of the norm? Then they wait and see if the one unwitting person in the room follows suit. I very distinctly remember one where everyone in a waiting room, except one woman, was told to stand up at the sound of a beep. In literally just three beeps, the woman started standing on cue with everyone else. I mean, she looked around, she was definitely confused, but she stood.
Yeah, so that is particularly cringy for me because I wonder if I would do that. I really wonder. I probably would. I don't know.
Bobby Jane, what's even crazier is when one by one, all the actors left the waiting room, the woman still stood at the beep, even when absolutely nobody was watching her. Nobody from that quote unquote in-group that Karen described.
Oh, my heart goes out to her.
I think we all would. But let's also talk about the groupthink component here. According to Janice, there are 8 symptoms of groupthink. 1, an illusion of invulnerability. Maybe that's a bit of an overstatement. What this means is that the group comes to think of itself as being really good at what it does. This means the group may take more risks than it should because it has incorrectly perceived its strengths. 2, unquestioned belief in the morality of the group. Again, I think we can interpret this to mean that the group believes it is superior to others, whether in intelligence, cleverness, morality, or in other qualities. 3, rationalizing warnings that would challenge the group's assumptions. Put another way, they refuse to consider alternative points of view. 4, stereotyping anyone who is against the group to demonize them. This can take the form of calling them biased, stupid, or even evil. 5, self-censorship of ideas that deviate from the group consensus. 6, illusions of unanimity among group members. 7, direct pressure on members to conform. And finally, 8, the presence of so-called mind guards. These are individuals who act as the group's police officers, acting to counter and prevent the transmission of any information that contradicts the group's ideas.
I love that there's structure in determining if groupthink is present. It is absolutely wild.
Right? And if these 8 symptoms sound suspiciously like signposts and indicators for whether you're in a cult, that's exactly right. Cults are an example of extremely malignant groupthink. If you ever find yourself involved in a group in which you're not allowed to raise questions and challenge ideas, get out of there fast. You're probably not in a healthy situation, or you're in the military.
I was about to say, wow, that is challenging. But I can also see how difficult that would be to go against the grain, especially when people, they want to be liked. They want to be accepted. They want a sense of belonging or simply keep their jobs, maybe in some instances.
Yeah, all of those are valid. But again, we have to think about this idea of malignancy and meeting various criteria. In terms of what causes groupthink, there are 2 factors I want to highlight. The first is structural faults in the organization of the group. Negative factors include insularity, which causes the group to develop inaccurate analysis or perspectives, leadership that rejects innovation and diversity of opinions, lack of structure to invite divergent thinking, and homogeneity among the members' backgrounds and ideology. All of these combine to create a group that can't or won't think creatively.
Okay, so that was the example of the military, right?
It can be, sure. The second factor is an emotionally difficult environment. Negative factors include highly stressful external threats that cause the group to behave irrationally, recent failures that cause the group to cling to cohesion as a defensive mechanism, and time pressure. Not all factors are present in all situations, and while a high degree of group cohesiveness is the most important factor in groupthink, a really cohesive group doesn't mean the group will automatically have groupthink.
Okay, so we understand what it is, how to spot it, and some causes. What can we do to combat groupthink?
Janice identified several steps to take to try to prevent groupthink. 1, leaders should remind group members to think of themselves as critical evaluators. This will encourage them to seek out and highlight competing or discrediting information. This includes encouraging members to discuss ideas with people outside the group. Additionally, at least one member should formally be designated to act as the devil's advocate in each meeting. 2, leaders should not express an opinion when assigning a task to a group. This will ensure that the group doesn't attempt to please the leader by conforming to their pre-established opinion. Similarly, leaders should avoid attending many group meetings to avoid unduly influencing it. 3, in the case of a larger organization, a leader should task several groups to work on the same problem. And 4, the group should invite outside experts to meetings and engage in robust conversations with them. Overall, devil's advocacy is the best way to challenge groupthink because it creates a structured, formalized path for members to offer conflicting opinions and raise alternative viewpoints. If the devil's advocate is able to present strong enough evidence, it will force the group to have to reassess its position and seek out different solutions. As listeners know, I'm such a fan of structured analytic techniques, and this just shows the positive impact they can have if we implement them.
I was just thinking how much I love this, Karen. We are literally seeing full circle precisely why you even started this podcast in the beginning. We help people identify cognitive biases, learn critical thinking and application through known analytical techniques. I absolutely love it. The best part of this podcast is how we break down these sometimes pretty technical topics by using more palatable subjects like celebrity gossip. I love that one. And the pop culture. And today, I think you guys did keep me a little bit in the dark about the pop culture topic. So if you could now tell me, what do we have today?
Let's talk about the Salem Witch Trials.
Okay. I mean, yes. How are we going to talk about them today?
If you grew up in a school system like mine, the Salem Witch Trials were a major topic of high school conversation. In my school, it was taught as an example of teenage hysteria or revenge, with a required reading of Arthur Miller's The Crucible. In my partner's school, it was taught as a cautionary tale of the danger of mob mentality. In other schools, it's used to demonstrate the dangers of religious extremism. But while we most commonly focus on the accusers and their victims, what about the average citizens of Massachusetts that went along with the trials? What about the judges presiding over the trials?
Wow. Okay, so groupthink has played like a pretty important part in some really dark moments in human history, huh?
Definitely. But to take a step back and remind our listeners of the backstory in this particular scenario, the Salem Witch Trials were a group of prosecutions and accusations of witchcraft that occurred in colonial Massachusetts between 1692 and 1693. Over 200 people were accused, with 30 found guilty and 20 killed. It's important to understand that this was hardly the first major witch trial in the Western world. Witch trials had occurred across Europe in the 17th century, but had already begun to fade out there by mid-century. America, meanwhile, at the fringes of this Western world, was just getting started with the first witchcraft execution in 1647 in Connecticut.
I feel like you should have a flashlight on your face right now going through this.
Who says I don't? Anyway, colonial New England was steeped in the idea that the devil was not only real, but actively stalking the area, looking to tempt sinners into evil. Women, viewed as the weaker sex, were particularly vulnerable to this temptation. In 1689, Boston-based minister Cotton Mather, by the way, his dad was Increase Mather, proving some people had horrible names, published Memorable Providences Relating to Witchcrafts and Possessions, in which he describes how a witch casts spells on the children of a Boston man, John Goodwin. As Mather describes it, four of the six children began to have fits, which included muscle pain, random outbursts, loss of bodily control, or trying to harm themselves or others. It's not a stretch to think that Mather's book or its contents reached and influenced the population in Salem Village. It was probably brought there, in fact, by the minister Samuel Parris, who came to Salem in 1689 from Boston. In February 1692, just 3 years later, Betty Parris, age 9, and her cousin Abigail Williams, age 11, began to have fits. They screamed, threw things, and crawled around like characters in a horror movie. They also claimed to feel that they were being pinched and pricked by pins. Their symptoms quickly spread to other young women in the village, sparking accusations of witches active in the area. Now, without going too deeply into all the granular details of the situation, let's try to understand what happened next using Janice's 8 symptoms of groupthink.
It's really interesting how it was the religious viewpoint that presided over these circumstances over like a medical approach. I mean, maybe they did both.
There are many different ways to understand the Salem Witch Trials. And in fact, if you read the Wikipedia page, there is a medical suggestion made. But applying Janice's groupthink criteria gives us an interesting perspective into why people in the immediate and wider area didn't immediately reject the claims of what were in essence young girls, that invisible specters were torturing them. And in particular, why the judges were so willing to believe the charges. Today, we might take a jaundiced view of young girls accusing neighbors of being witches, but can groupthink explain, at least in part, why people back then took them so seriously? Let's see. 1. Did the local population have an illusion of invulnerability? Yeah, we could certainly understand it that way. The New England Puritans viewed themselves as striving on the path of righteousness, and far exceeding others not on that path, to include Anglicans and Catholics. And in fact, many of those accused of witchcraft were accused of having rejected Puritan ideas, and were thus inferior to the group. That same in-group, out-group dynamic that Janice identified in groupthink. Moreover, the longer the trials went on, the more the families of the accusers felt emboldened to make further accusations. 2. Did the local population have an unquestioned belief in their morality? As we've just discussed, yes, the Puritans were all about superior morality, and the judges would have seen themselves especially as the beacons of morality and purity. 3. Did the local population refuse to consider alternative points of view? Yes, or at least the majority seems to have. Martha Corey was a member of the local church, but when she expressed skepticism about witchcraft and her belief that the accusers were lying, she ended up finding herself accused with no one to defend her but her husband Giles, who was also accused of witchcraft. The same thing happened to John Proctor, whose wife Elizabeth Proctor had also been accused. If you suggested any theory about witchcraft as the cause of the accuser's afflictions, you risked being executed for witchcraft.
Wow, so to my point earlier, like how hard it is to go against the grain, their very lives were literally at stake for speaking out. Wow.
Yeah, people were absolutely killed for speaking out. But to continue, 4. Did the local population stereotype anyone or demonize them? Literally by definition, yes. But let's give a specific example. When Bridget Bishop was tried, she was described as not meeting Puritan morals because she wore bright colors and exotic outfits. She also stayed up late hosting guests, drinking and playing shovelboard, all of which went against community standards.
So this even went further. This extended into people who aren't like us, with my quote fingers, mentality. Literally people outside of the prevailing group think bubble. I mean, this seriously escalated.
Well, it's in-group, out-group. But things like this often escalate. As we say about the French Revolution, the revolution eats its children. I think the point here is that once something like this is set in motion, it tends to snowball and get out of the control of anyone, like a wildfire. But let's finish out our count. 5. Did group members engage in self-censorship to avoid challenging the group consensus? Yes. In late February 1692, Mary Sibley tried to use an English folk white magic practice to identify who was the witch tormenting the first two Salem accusers. When condemned by the local reverend for this use of well-intentioned magic, she apologized and was forgiven by the congregation and restored to full good standing, thus avoiding herself being accused of witchcraft. You can bet after accusations began flying and anyone who objected to the trials came under scrutiny, most people with doubts kept quiet for the sake of self-preservation. 6. Were there illusions of unanimity among group members? Yes, and especially among the judges. In June 1692, as the Salem witch trials were getting into swing, Cotton Mather and other ministers wrote to the court warning that it should be very critical and practice exquisite caution in the matter, lest the court get out of control and prosecute unjustly. But the court members, focusing on other parts of that same letter that supported the trials, ignored this admonition and pressed on with even greater vigor. Major Nathaniel Saltonstall resigned that month from the court, becoming the only man associated with the trials to condemn the trials in their initial stages. In his absence, the court had its unanimity. 7. Was there direct pressure on group members to conform? Yes. Although not a parishioner in Salem, William Milburn, a Baptist minister in Boston, had to post a $42,000 bond or be arrested after publicly petitioning the Massachusetts General Assembly not to use spectral evidence in witchcraft trials. This is indicative of the pressure in the area in general to support charges of witchcraft and the belief that the devil was stalking the land. And not to mention that several women accused of witchcraft admitted to the charge, then themselves turned into accusers of other women. One way to avoid being scapegoated was to identify new scapegoats. And finally, 8. Were there mind guards that worked to reinforce the group's ideas and beat back any contradictory evidence? Yes. At his execution in August 1692, George Burroughs recited the Lord's Prayer, which witches were believed to be unable to do. The watching crowd grew uneasy, feeling he may have been unjustly killed. Cotton Mather, who was present at the hanging, reaffirmed Burroughs' guilt and paved the way for the remaining executions conducted that day.
We only have 30 minutes on this podcast, but I am so tempted to ask, how does this even happen? How did something so insanely extreme occur? The fact that if you even questioned anything, your entire life was at stake has me thinking the entire town, the entire geographic region was in fact a cult.
Well, not exactly a cult per se, but certainly in isolated, highly religious areas, there may be cult-like characteristics. But when we think about the judges who presided over the Salem witch trials, we find they were situationally ripe for groupthink. Massachusetts was relatively geographically insulated, with limited access to the new modernized ideas coming out of Europe. The judges actively rejected diverse opinions, clinging to superstitious views of religion that allowed for ideas like witches sending their specters to haunt and torment others. The men were extremely homogeneous in their backgrounds and education, and they found themselves in what to them was a high-pressure, high-stakes situation. If the witches continued unchecked, the very souls of Salem could be in jeopardy. As a result, they had to act definitively to counter what they perceived as the devil's influence in Salem. In this case, how was the groupthink broken? In October 1692, only 8 months after the first charges of witchcraft were leveled, it was an outsider who finally put the kibosh on the matter. Province of Massachusetts Bay Governor Sir William Phipps, returning from fighting in Maine, paused court proceedings out of concern that innocent victims would be condemned. A new court was convened with stricter evidence rules, and eventually a new Chief Justice was appointed who was significantly more moderate. In this case, we might say that Phipps played the devil's advocate, arguing in the defense of the accused.
Okay, so this was a very extreme case of groupthink, right? I'm sure we have more examples that are a little bit more relatable or subtle. Caitlin, what do you have for us?
I don't know about relatable or subtle, but one of the most famous examples of groupthink in history and technology is the 1986 Challenger space shuttle explosion.
Hold up, quick cue. The Challenger explosion, correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought that was a tragedy that was caused by a technical or equipment malfunction type thing. Are you saying groupthink caused that, and how so?
Well, maybe caused is a little bit of a strong word, but definitely contributed to. Let me give a little background so we're all on the same page. NASA's launch of the Challenger space shuttle was set for a very chilly January 28, 1986. It was a big day for the organization, and tons of media was present, in large part because the seven-person crew included Kristen McAuliffe, a high school teacher nominated by her students to fly as part of NASA's Teacher in Space program. While also checking off some of the boxes for NASA's space exploration goals, the flight would be proof that space was really open to average Americans. But only 73 seconds after the Challenger's launch, the space shuttle exploded, and for the first time, NASA lost a crew on a mission. Millions of Americans watched in horror as the shuttle first blew apart and then rained back to the Earth in fiery parts.
Quick comment. I know that we've all probably seen this on replays, but since we're constantly offending me with ageism on this podcast, none of us were actually of the age to have seen it live, right?
No, not me, but I have watched the Netflix documentary about it. But back to it. What caused this disaster? In the months after the accident, a presidential commission was launched to comb through the evidence and answer that very question. And well, as you alluded to, Bobby Jane, an equipment malfunction was the most direct cause of the explosion. A leak in the booster caused a flame that eventually burned through the shuttle's external hydrogen tank, rupturing it and causing the explosion. The source of the leak was traced down to a very tiny rubber part called an O-ring, which formed a seal between sections of the rocket boosters. Now, it was known to NASA scientists and decision makers that this was a quote-unquote potentially catastrophic element of the space shuttle, and that this part specifically was extremely sensitive to a number of things, including the cold. And in the Challenger's case, it was really cold the day of the launch, so the ring didn't expand properly, causing the leak and ultimately the explosion.
So a faulty O-ring caused the disaster, but Caitlin, help me. How is this related to groupthink?
If you look closely enough, the Challenger event shows that NASA was a powder keg of groupthink that only needed a match to burst. Some already pre-existing circumstances or precursors existed at NASA that made it hard for the organization as a whole to overcome its groupthink bias. For example, NASA, specifically the top decision-making team tasked with coordinating the Challenger launch, was very familiar with each other, as they had worked together for years prior to 1986. We often think of group cohesiveness as a pro for decision-making, but this really isn't always the case. In cohesive groups, decisions can be made quickly and with high levels of consensus, but these decisions are not always the best decisions. Sometimes, the best decisions are born out of contention when alternatives are brought to the table and then they're fully fleshed out.
Okay, I'm trying to stay with you here. Are you saying the O-ring, the fact that it was known, or you're saying that it was well known to be problematic, but due to pressure to stay on the course or get the launch out, which we had a good amount of publicity for, is the cause where we get to the groupthink fail? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, kind of how Karen said earlier, dysfunction. And I can explain it better by using symptoms of groupthink that Karen also discussed earlier as a framework to examine some of the events leading up to the explosion. So one, did NASA leaders have an illusion of invulnerability? Well, most definitely. Even now, after the Challenger explosion and some of the other blunders that NASA has made, it's still known as a prestigious organization. But back in the 1980s, and after so many successful launches, NASA's reputation was impenetrable. So much so that NASA itself had trouble living up to its own popularity and public pressure, hence some of the rush to not delay the launch. 2. Did NASA leaders have an unquestioned belief in their own morality? I think we could see it that way. Physicist Erwin Schrödinger said, "Scientific knowledge forms part of the idealistic background of human life, which allowed humans to transition from a savage state to true humanity." I think in this case, the scientists believed a little too strongly in their own understanding of science, operating on thin safety margins with a lot of overconfidence. 3. Did NASA leaders refuse to consider alternative points of view? Yes. And I think this symptom of groupthink proved to be the most catastrophic for the Challenger. In the days and hours before the launch, scientists reported that the O-rings had not been tested in temperatures as low as launch day temperatures. NASA leadership, however, decided not to consider the alternative point of view that the O-rings could possibly fail under the launch circumstances. In NASA leadership's eyes, there was no time to consider alternatives.
Okay, no time. That's the pressure aspects that I think I was getting to. There must have been some time pressure on them.
Most definitely. That leads me to 4. Did the NASA leadership stereotype anyone or demonize them? Okay, to be honest, I'm not really sure here, but I'd be willing to bet NASA engaged in some sort of degradation of the Soviet space system as a means of boosting its own self-image. 5. Did NASA leaders engage in self-censorship to avoid challenging the group consensus? Definitely. Some NASA decision makers decided to completely ignore and not communicate up the concerns that engineers had about the O-rings. The issue was even completely left out of all the flight readiness documentation that was created leading up to the Challenger launch.
Oh, wow.
I know, it's insane. 6. Were there illusions of unanimity among NASA leaders? Yes, particularly among high-ranking NASA officials. Those responsible for NASA public relations were gung-ho for launch because it provided an opportunity for large amounts of publicity. Krista McAuliffe would broadcast a lesson live from space on her 4th day aboard the Challenger. A January 28th launch ensured this lesson would take place on a school day rather than a weekend. Further, President Ronald Reagan was due to discuss the Challenger in his State of the Union address early the next week. If the launch was delayed, the president would not be able to use the event as a success in his speech.
Oh my goodness. I think if I recall, this is why it had gotten the public so emotionally involved, because they saw so much of the process and the teacher and the classmates.
Yeah, it was a huge public relations nightmare for NASA after, which also leads me to 7. Was there direct pressure on the leaders to conform? Yes. This was a national event scheduled to take place on a certain day and at a certain time. NASA was seeking to launch as many as 25 similar missions that year and was already behind schedule.
Yep. There's that pressure.
Exactly, Bobby Jane. And lastly, 8. Were there quote-unquote mind guards that worked to reinforce NASA leadership's ideas and beat back any contradictory evidence? Yes. NASA's employment structure caused engineers to be isolated from the core decision-making group. When engineers were making recommendations to not launch, facts were misconstrued, engineers' opinions were dismissed, and ultimately the decision to launch was made in contradiction of what the subject matter experts said.
My goodness, I can't even imagine being one of those engineers trying to sound the alarm, or even worse, ones that didn't. The immense guilt that they must feel. And I know both of you would have lost your minds in a similar situation.
Yeah, Bobby Jane, you're definitely right. And an unchecked groupthink bias can have impacts that we're only able to recognize in hindsight. We've talked about artificial intelligence or AI in other episodes, but I think it's worth bringing up again. When we think about AI, I think we all like to envision a neutral and objective technology, completely void of bias, what some would see as a uniquely human flaw. But that's just not true. The reality is that algorithms, since they're designed by people, are very often not neutral and not impartial. And when humans in society who create algorithms use impartial data, it's very likely that their AI algorithms will too, a phenomenon called algorithmic bias. And when these biased algorithms are widely used, it can cause a sort of digital groupthink that perpetuates bad information and leads to really poor decision making.
I wish we had more time. I learned a lot today, especially the new way of thinking about these historical events and the impact of this cognitive bias. It really never does end. It never ceases to amaze me. I'm always extremely impressed by your ability to teach our listeners about the importance of critical thinking. And I really do appreciate both of you. And I think our listeners do too. So that wraps up this week's episode of Groupthink. And next week, we will be discussing anchor bias. And let me tell you in advance, no, it has nothing to do with sailing. So tune in and join us next time, and we'll learn all about it. Thank you. And thank you for listening to Gossipint.